We take you back. CBS News now presents a special program marking the 20th anniversary of the inauguration of a new form of journalism. To tell you about it, here is Dallas Townsend.
Good evening. Let's go back two decades in time. A rearmed Germany is marching toward the conquest of a continent, and the American people turn to radio to keep up with the headlong pace of events.
I've seen nearly all the big military reviews here since Sir Hitler came to power, and I've seen some pretty big ones in France and Italy. But today's parade of the cream of the new German army must certainly have been the greatest display of military power that modern Europe has ever seen.
That was William L. Shirer reporting shortwave from Berlin to CBS News in New York. The time, almost a generation ago, Europe was plunging toward World War II, and Adolf Hitler was riding high.
Und wenn ich jetzt spreche, dieses deutsche Volkes bin, dann weiß ich.
As the momentum of catastrophic events increased, a new form of journalism was confronted with its greatest challenge and its supreme opportunity. CBS News, exploring and developing a relatively untried medium under pressure of fast-moving world events, pioneered in the type of news program that featured multiple direct reports, usually by shortwave, from correspondents assigned to places where the news was being made. On March 13, 1938, with the Nazis overrunning Austria and Munich still several months away, CBS News, under the supervision of its first director, Paul White, first presented this new type of program to American listeners. Tonight, exactly 20 years later, we mark the anniversary by recalling a few memorable moments and voices you may have heard on these programs in the recent past. We make no claim to be inclusive. There are many other moments and voices that time forces us to omit. We ask your indulgence and your memories as we take you back. The day now is September 3rd, 1939. The time, a few minutes after 6 a.m. in New York. The reporter, Robert Trout.
Great Britain is now at war with Germany. Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain announced this fact in a broadcast at 6:15 New York time, 6:15 Eastern Daylight Time.
The reporter in London, Edward R. Murrow.
This is London calling Columbia, New York. Now first, let's get in proper order the chronological developments of the day. At 9 o'clock this morning, London time, it was announced that a two-hour ultimatum had been delivered to Germany, that at the end of that time, hostilities must cease, or Germany and Britain would be at war. At 11:15, the Prime Minister spoke to the nation.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note, stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Shortly after the Prime Minister's speech, the air raid sirens went off, and it wasn't a pleasant sound. We moved quietly and in orderly fashion down underground. The all clear came in just a little while. It seems that an unidentified plane had been seen approaching the coast. It was later found to be a friendly ship.
The struggle that began that September day seemed at times to be going on forever. Less than 10 months later, the Allied forces in disastrous rout were reeling back before the panzers and the Luftwaffe. Numbed and broken, France decided to surrender, and a triumphant German army set its engineers and technicians to work to set up a shortwave broadcast from the surrender scene. Bill Shirer, who had watched Hitler rise to power, saw the German dictator now at the pinnacle of his mad career as he accepted the French capitulation in the famous railroad car in the forest of Compiègne. America listened as Shirer described it.
Hitler and the other German leaders rise from their feet as the French enter the drawing room. Hitler, we see, gives the Nazi salute, the arm raised. The German officers give a military salute. The French do the same. Hitler, so far as we can see through the windows just in front of us here, does not say anything. He nods to General Keitel at his side. We can see General Keitel adjusting his papers, and then he starts to read. He is reading the preamble of the German armistice terms. The French sit there with marble-like faces and listen intently. Hitler and Goering glance at the green tabletop.
Scheurer's voice, calm and unemotional, even when describing the French surrender, became a familiar one in American households during the war. Other voices also became familiar.
8:55 Eastern Time, and Columbia and its affiliated stations bring you Elmer Davis and the news.
Serious riots are going on in Milan and elsewhere in northern Italy, according to information reaching diplomats in Yugoslavia and reported by our correspondent in Belgrade, Winston Burdett. There seems to have been some sort of military rising, either against the fascist party or against the German troops, who are reported as numerous in northern Italy, for three high Italian officers are said to have been killed by Germans who intervened, and black shirt units are assisting the Germans in repressing the disorders. German soldiers are said to have occupied the Milan railroad station and telephone, telegraph, and radio offices, and also to be guarding the principal factories. Turin and various other places in the Po Valley are also the scene of rioting, and the casualties are said to run up into the hundreds. This information is not yet corroborated from other sources, but Mr. Burdett is the correspondent who got the first news of the arrival of German troops and planes in Italy. And our correspondent Harry Flannery reported from Berlin tonight that papers there speak of endless trainloads of the German Air Force as going through the Brenner Pass toward Italian soil.
Then, of course, there was H.V. Kaltenborn, sometimes referred to as the Dean.
Kaltenborn edits the news.
Good evening, everybody. For months past, there has been a contest of wits between the President of the United States and the Washington reporters. They have sought to make him tell what he intends to do about a third term. He has sought, by banter, persiflage, clever answer, smiles, and occasional silence, not to tell him. How long can that battle of wits go on without somebody losing his temper? The president thus far has been unusually patient with respect to these persistent inquiries. Perhaps he feels that they are justified by public curiosity and public interest. But of course, as president, if he wanted to, he could have Steve Early tell the boys, now see here, no more questions about the third term, or we'll cut out the press conferences.
Also, Major George Fielding Elliott, the military analyst, a familiar presence at CBS News microphones in times of crisis, such as the German assault on Russia in June 1941.
There is no reliable news as to the progress of military operations in the Russo-German conflict. Military circles are inclined to the view that one major German drive will develop along the Karelian Isthmus, scene of heavy fighting in the Russo-Finnish War last winter. This drive will probably be directed initially upon Leningrad. Leningrad is of some importance as an industrial center. It is Russia's main naval shipbuilding area, and nearby Kronstadt is the principal Russian naval base on the Baltic, whose loss would greatly hamper Russian naval operations.
Thus, the conflict widened, and 6 months later, it widened again. Sunday, December 7th, 1941, 2:30 p.m., and Albert Warner, then chief of the CBS News Bureau in Washington, found himself reporting one of the biggest stories of a lifetime from a few hastily scribbled notes.
Just now comes the word from the president's office that a second air attack has been reported on Army and Navy bases in Manila. Thus, we have official announcements from the White House that Japanese airplanes have attacked Pearl Harbor in Hawaii and have now attacked Army and Navy bases in Manila. We return you now to New York and will give you later information as it comes along from the White House. Return you now to New York.
John Daly was anchoring the program that afternoon in New York.
London, in many respects, has correlated its moves in the Far Eastern situation with the progress of the American-Japanese discussions in Washington. Australia and Singapore and other Crown colonies have been made ready for any eventuality, and the Far Eastern fleet has been created, headed by the 35,000-ton Prince of Wales. For a direct report on British reaction to the latest moves in the Near East and the Far East, Bob Trout is standing by in the British capital. Go ahead, London.
London heard its first news of the attacks on Hawaii and the Philippines from John Charles Daly in New York just a few moments ago. The report had not arrived in London before this Columbia program began. It is, of course, too early to give you any reaction, but as you know, the British government made plain what would happen if America became involved in war with Japan some days ago. We did get earlier that official report from Singapore that British air reconnaissance in the South China Seas had confirmed the earlier reports of Japanese activities. Japanese naval vessels, including cruisers, seen off the southern tip of Indochina, steaming toward the northwest. That announcement backed up those earlier dispatches from Washington, telling of heavy Japanese troop concentrations in Indochina, both ashore and afloat. About the president's message to the Emperor of Japan, we heard nothing except the announcement that a message had been sent.
And after Trout finished his report from London, Daly had more news from the Pacific.
We have been on the telephone with our station in KGMB, which is in Honolulu, and they report to us that the attacking planes number between 50 and 100, that the air raid is still on, and that the anti-aircraft fire can be heard in a steady drone as the attacking planes come in. We received a bulletin just a little while ago which reported that there have been some of these, what Manila Corps, rather Honolulu, calls unidentified planes shot down. And this latest report now from KGMB is all that we have to the moment. We will continue to receive reports from there, also from Washington, on the developments in our relations with Japan, the relations which will tell very shortly the story of what is to happen in the months that are to come.
Two nights later,
from the White House in Washington, D.C., ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, the sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung at the United States of America. The Japanese have treacherously violated the long-standing peace between us. Many American soldiers and sailors have been killed by enemy action. American ships have been sunk.
As the Allied forces swung into action against the Axis, CBS News correspondents went along with them, reporting from around the world their personal observations of the global conflict. Ed Murrow, back in London, after a raid over Berlin on a bomber known as D for Dog, told about it in a report that became known as the Orchestrated Hell broadcast.
The smoke was getting thick down below. Mars said he liked the two green flares on the ground almost dead ahead. He began calling his directions. And just then, a new bunch of big flares went down on the far side of the sea of flame and flare that seemed to be directly below us. He thought that would be a better aiming point.
Jock agreed, and we flew on.
The bomb doors were open. Boz called his direction. Five left, five left. And then there was a gentle, confident upward thrust under my feet, and Boz said, "Cookie gone." A few seconds later, the incendiaries went. And D-Dog seemed lighter and easier to handle. I thought I could make out the outline of streets below.
But the bomb aimer didn't agree,
and he ought to know. By this time, all those patches of white on black had turned yellow and started to flow together. Another searchlight caught us, but didn't hold us. Then through the intercom came the word, "One can of incendiaries didn't clear. We're still carrying it." And Jock replied, "Is it a big one or a little one?" The word came back, "Little one, I think, but I'm not sure. I'll check." More of those yellow flares came down and hung about it. I haven't seen so much light since the war began. Finally, the intercom announced that it was only a small container of incendiaries left, and Jock remarked, "Well, it's hardly worth going back and doing another run-up for that. If there had been a good fat bundle left, he would have gone back through that stuff and done it all over again. I began to breathe and to reflect again that all men would be brave if only they could leave their stomachs at home. When there was a tremendous whoomp, an unintelligible shout from the tail gunner, and D-Dog shivered and lost altitude. I looked to the port side, and there was a Lancaster that seemed close enough to touch. He had whipped straight under us, missed us by 25, 50 feet. No one knew how much. The navigator sang out the new course, and we were heading for home. We flew level then. I looked on the port beam at the target area. There was a red, sullen, obscene glare. The fires seemed to have found each other. And we were heading home. In little more than half an hour, Berlin had received about three times the weight of bombs that had ever fallen on London in the course of a long winter night. Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame.
6 months later, when the Allies invaded Fortress Europe, CBS News correspondents went along. Charles Collingwood, now the CBS News correspondent in London, reported from a Normandy beachhead on D-Day, June 6, 1944.
We are on the beach today, on D-Day. We have just seen one of the strangest and most remarkable sights of this invasion so far. Two great fleets of over 100 gliders have gone overhead, towed by C-47 transports, who are certainly proving the workhorses of this invasion. They've hauled them right over the beaches, and it seems as though the German gunners, amazed at this incredible sight, have stopped firing on the beach now because it's quiet here, and the second batch are droning over now. I can see them. They're casting off the gliders as they circle around over the beach, and the transports are circling around and beginning to make off home. Where they're landing, we don't know because we're down here on the beach, and there's a seawall in front of us, and we can't see the land behind.
As the Allied forces drove into Normandy, American listeners heard Bill Downs, among many others, from the front.
British troops are advancing southeast to the town of Tilly today and already have gained some 2.5 to 3 miles. This fighting breaks the pause which has held in the British-Canadian sector for the past 10 days. Today's advance pushes another bulge out of the beachhead line at a point some 8 miles west of Caen. The ground gained today represents only a local advance. But any advance on this sector can only spell more trouble for the Germans. Prisoners and knocked-out enemy equipment are still being counted, but at least 9 enemy tanks are believed to have been destroyed.
Perhaps the war's most significant development came only when it was almost over.
We are delaying the start of our scheduled program to bring you the latest direct report on the atomic bomb attack on Japan. CBS World News takes you now to Guam. Webley Edwards reporting.
The men who have applied the greatest weapon ever developed, the atomic bomb, are close-mouthed, serious, and highly impressed with the world-shaking magnitude of what they've done. We talked with Colonel Paul W. Tibbetts, Jr. of Miami, Florida, pilot of the B-29 that dropped the first atomic bomb in history. You asked him how he felt about it, and he said he didn't feel anything much, but you knew from talking to him that he sensed the meaning of that bomb's away, and he felt solemn about it. Colonel Tibbetts, bombardier, Major Tom Farabee of Marksville, North Carolina, and Navy Captain William Parsons of Chicago and Santa Fe, New Mexico, the latter a weaponeer responsible for last-minute checkup of the bomb. Only these three in the plane knew the import of that bomb dropping. And Captain Parsons said, "We made fast distance between the target and ourselves. And then I breathed a sigh of relief and knew it had worked."
And when the endless struggle finally did end, the American people listened by shortwave as Japan surrendered. This was the way it looked to Webley Edwards, reporting for CBS News from the battleship Missouri.
Here comes the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, General of the Army, Douglas MacArthur, William Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, and other dignitaries.
General MacArthur is now facing the microphones. He is about to start his speech, which explains the signing surrender and also causing.
Representatives
of the major warring powers to conclude a solemn agreement whereby peace may be restored. The issues involving divergent ideals and ideologies have been determined on the battlefields of the world, and hence are not for our discussion or debate, but rather it is for us, both victors and vanquished, to rise to that higher dignity which alone befits the sacred purposes we are about to serve, committing all of our peoples unreservedly to faithful compliance with the undertakings they are here formally to assume.
Over the war years and the years that followed, many distinguished reporters have been identified with the CBS News programs that featured these reports from around the world. And many of them are still with CBS News. Of them all, Edward R. Murrow and Robert Trout have had perhaps the longest and closest association with these programs. In fact, both of them took part in that inaugural roundup 20 years ago tonight. Both of them are here now to join us in taking a backward glance. First, Bob Trout.
Sunday, March 13th, 1938, was in some respects much like any other day. The civilized world seemed poised on the verge of destruction. Easter was on the way. It was chilly in New York, but warmer in Florida. And in Paris, after days of fretting, the French had just formed a new cabinet. Until 8 o'clock that Sunday night, no one on this earth had ever heard a world news roundup. Not that we called that first program a roundup. When I went on the air to introduce the 35-minute program, I called it a special broadcast which will include pickups direct from London, Paris, and such other European capitals as, at this late hour abroad, have communications channels available. 2 days earlier, on Friday, the German army had marched across the frontier into Austria in its first offensive since 1914, and a new word entered our language here in America. It was Anschluss. For many a day and sleepless night, CBS News had been broadcasting an account of Adolf Hitler's mounting campaign of pressure against the Austrians and, finally, the virtually unresisted invasion. CBS News consisted chiefly of a suite of offices here on the 17th floor of this building on Madison Avenue in New York. I was called the voice of CBS News, not a correspondent. There were no radio correspondents then. News director Paul W. White had had curtains hung on the walls of one of the offices here to deaden the sound, rigging up an improvised studio for the crisis. Many of our meals were brought into us from outside, and we often took naps on one of the studio couches. In Europe, Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's European director, had gone to Poland to arrange a broadcast as part of his administrative duties. America had not yet heard that famous voice saying every night, "This is London." William L. Shirer, whom Ed Murrow had hired to be Columbia's Central European director, was holding down the fort in London. Suddenly, on that Sunday after the German troops marched in, the Germans reopened the broadcasting station in Vienna, and Ed Murrow hurried from Warsaw to Vienna. So, on this first broadcast from more than one European city on the same program, our director from London spoke from Vienna, while the Central European man spoke to us from London. Actually, we didn't have much hope of bringing in Ed Murrow from Vienna. I'd written a little apology explaining that the Vienna transmitter was closed and had not prepared a Vienna introduction in advance either. Newspaper correspondents overseas played a large part in that first roundup, as we didn't have correspondents of our own. Edgar Maurer of the Chicago Daily News in Paris, Pierre Huss, INS, in Berlin. When I switched to him, I said, "Hermann Göring, the number two Nazi, left in charge of Germany's capital while Hitler tours Austria, is hinting again that Germany's next objective is Czechoslovakia." As I introduced Frank Gervasi, INS, in Italy, I said, apparently shocked by the German advance to Italy's northern border, Rome quickly recovered, announcing that the German invasion was started with Italian approval. And we used legislators as reporters, too. In London, William Shirer introduced the late Ellen C. Wilkinson, a member of Parliament. And a senator had the last word, Senator Louis Schwellenbach of Washington State, a Democratic member of the Foreign Relations Committee, performed as our final newsman. By the next day, congratulations were coming in for what many called the International Round Table. So that next night, Monday, we did it all over again, and the roundup was launched. And Dallas, look what we started.
Thank you very much, Bob Trout. And now, Ed Murrow.
Before the Anschluss, arranging broadcasts from Europe was a leisurely, civilized sort of business. Plenty of time to read and to see your friends. It involved such things as relaying to this country the Vatican choir at Easter time, a speech by De Valera, folk music from Scandinavia, the song of a nightingale in a Surrey wood. After the Anschluss, things became rather more interesting and considerably more hectic. We began to recruit our own staff of reporters. A radio reporter is a special kind of animal. He requires to know what he is writing about, must be able to write it, and after that's done, he must be able to read it in such a fashion as to be believable. In putting together our crew in Europe, I tried to concentrate on finding people who were young and who knew what they were talking about, without bothering too much about diction, phrasing, and manner of speaking. There were occasional complaints from the Home Office on this score, which were generally answered by saying that we were trying to collect a group of reporters who would be steady, reliable, and restrained, even though they might not win any elocution contests. In those days, before and during most of the war, we were not permitted to use recordings. Everything was live and moved directly from the reporter's microphone into your home. There were no editors or rewrite men who might tone down or hot up the copy as a result of their working in a more detached and tranquil atmosphere. We had no budget. Nobody gave orders. New York asked us only to find the news, try to report it, and keep our heads. When we made a mistake, we tried to be the first to correct it. I don't recall that anyone ever objected to an assignment, and we never developed a habit of second-guessing each other on stories. Risks were run as a matter of course, and no one ever tried to examine how the other fellow felt about it or expound about his own reactions. You get more of that kind of stuff on a dull evening on television than I heard in Europe, North Africa, and Korea. I think it would be fair to say that we were pridefully serious about our job, but not too serious about ourselves. And all felt that words were puny things indeed, to use in the effort to collapse distance between the men who were fighting and those who were at home. We argued with the censor, argued with each other. Sleep was a luxury. Every day was important. And most of us were frequently filled with a sense of black futility, bordering upon despair, because we couldn't do a better job. But we didn't talk much about that either. It's difficult to realize or admit that 20 years have passed since that first multiple point pickup. For my own part, I have not yet reached the age where my reminiscences fascinate me. One of the advantages in reporting through a medium as fast as radio is that you don't have the time or the inclination to look back. The next story is the important one. The place names, all the way from the Nile to the Nakhtong, the names and faces of friends who were dead and those who were lucky, are all a little vague. The door of memory is only slightly ajar, and it is necessary to close it completely when that red light goes on and the microphone is hot, lest we remember too much of the past and understand too little of the present. The echoes of old broadcasts are not a good sonar device to determine either the present or the future. This particular type of radio reporting is only 20 years old. The 21st year, in humans, is supposed to produce maturity and responsibility. The best in radio reporting is yet to be.
It might be added, of course, that these programs spent their first 20 years in a continuing world crisis, so perhaps they came of age early. In any event, as we hope we've succeeded in reminding you, the first generation has been a lively one. This is Dallas Townsend. Good night.
You have been listening to We Take You Back, a special program commemorating the start of regular CBS News broadcasts featuring multiple direct reports from around the world. This program brought you the voices of CBS News correspondents, past and present, and was presented by CBS News.
This is the CBS Radio Network.